Hi, I'm Ali Muldrow, the host of A Public Affair on Wednesdays. If you'd like to tune into my show any day of the week, any hour of the day, head on over to WORTFM.org. And while you're there, make a donation to support community radio.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.
Oh, good afternoon, Madison. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM. Madison, this is A Public Affair. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow, because it's Wednesday. And today we are incredibly fortunate to get to have my friend Pernicia Clifton on the show with us. She is a renowned opera singer. She is currently serving as the Director of Youth Protection and Compliance at the University of Wisconsin System. And she's also just, you know, to me, the right person to talk to at this moment in terms of this vast analysis of the intersections of violence and gender and race. And I think, you know, if you've been paying attention to the news lately, you've probably seen these really like brutal moments in terms of what is happening to women of color, what is happening to women of color when they go to work, what is happening to little girls who call the police and ask for help. And you are the person I wanted to have that conversation with. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Oh, I am doing very well, Ali. Thank you so much for having me. And it's truly an honor to be here to talk to you all. And I'm really coming from a lens, like, you know, I do all this stuff for work, but really my background in life or my mission in life was to serve over 1 million kids. And so what does that look like? It's through programming, it's through policy, it's through whatever kind of support you can do. So I am a certified Presidium Guardian, which means that I am trained on how to mitigate abuse to children. I'm also a certified mental health first aid trainer, which a certified youth mental health first aid trainer. So I teach people how to have these tough conversations with youth when they're in the middle of mental health crises. And then also I am a Black woman and I am a Black auntie to Black nieces. And so I wanted to talk from that perspective, not necessarily the work perspective or the opera perspective, but what it is to be a woman of color that's made it their life mission to protect children, specifically Black children, and to talk about the outcomes of what happens when we don't protect them or let alone allow them to be children. So I'm excited to have this conversation today.
I feel like You make me want to quote Malcolm X, right? The most disrespected person in America is the black woman, the most neglected, the most unprotected, right? And to talk about how the reality of Black women is projected onto Black children, and is something that connects Black women and Black children. Is a conversation I think more and more people want to have. And one of the reasons I think more and more people want to talk about what's going on with Black women and what's happening to brown women and what's happening to Asian women in America and around the world is because I watched The Handmaid's Tale and I'm like, man, they really want to translate this to white women so that they can have a problem with it, so that they can have a problem with the sorts of things that have happened to women of color throughout history. And so I think talking about it when it's us, without projecting it onto whiteness, without creating a dramatization, without Margaret Atwood, you're having a conversation in real time, right? A 15-year-old girl was just brutally murdered in Ohio by the police after she called the police for help. And I talked to you immediately after the women, the Asian women who were working at the salon were killed, because the debate became, was he racist or sexist? Was he fetishizing them? And that was the motive, or did he, you know, hate them for the kind of anti-Asian sentiment that's been sparked and fueled by Donald Trump's response to COVID-19. And it was kind of a question of, was this racist or was this sexist? And I kept thinking, why can't it be? Why can't we say both? This is both.
What about the intersectionality of hate?
Talk to us about both.
Yes. And why can't we hold them accountable for both? It's not just either or. And when I think about that, I think about the number of times that, like, I've been on dating sites and been like, no, I'm not really interested in you, but thank you for your interest. And the immediate response is, I'm called a B. Or the immediate response is, I'm called a stuck up, blah, blah, blah. Or their immediate response is, don't let me see you out on the street. Right? Whoa. We're not even allowed to say no. We're not allowed to have an opinion. If for some men, if they show women attention, that should be enough to get a response. And I've seen a lot of domestic violence incidences, especially between youth, even, you know, not handling rejection, and how that's played out within relationships of teens, and also in how that's played out with relationships of adults. What does it mean to be taught to handle rejection? What does it mean to learn at a young age that it's okay to be told no? But some of our youth and some of the people in our community are not taught this. And one of the workshops that I do with my organization, Seeing is Believing, is the power of no. And I have it presented by performers. Who better to talk about rejection than performers who get up and get rejected day after day until they get that one yes to get on stage? And there are studies that show the more that you teach youth about rejection at a younger age, the more you can combat domestic violence, the more you can combat violence against women. But yet we don't see these workshops and we don't see these conversations coming up with youth. And then we're shocked when someone who is overly aroused by someone can't get the attention they want, and then they shoot up a salon. So I think there's so much that can be done in this area to protect women. There's education that can be a mitigation. There is accountability that can be a mitigation. And then there is stepping up. We are the first people, Black women are the first people, women are the first people to step up and protect others. Mm-hmm. But yet we seem to be the last to be protected. So yeah, I had a soapbox moment.
I appreciated that moment. And if you are just joining the show, you are in for an outstanding conversation with Pernicia Clifton, who is a renowned opera singer. She was the first Black woman to sing opera in China. She has a long history of working with youth, and she is currently serving as the Director of Youth Protection and Compliance at the University of Wisconsin System. I think, you know, I felt like I would
have to correct the whole description. I was the first African-American woman to sing in a Chinese opera house solely in Mandarin. So I was brought over there to perform in Mandarin and learn Mandarin opera. There have been other Black singers that have been over there and performed, but my specialty was in Mandarin.
I was not going to be able to articulate like that. But yes. So the point is that you are phenomenal. You know, you're just a phenomenal person who's done incredible work in the arts and in terms of what you're doing with young people and for young people. But working for the University of Wisconsin System, you know, I think about campus sexual assault. And I think about, you know, when we talk about violence against women, domestic violence, sexual assault, aren't those kind of the unifying experiences for women? Isn't that what Black women and white women and rich women and poor women and women all over the world have in common? Is there the need to talk about the very specific brutality that Black women or brown women face when all women are, you know, more likely to experience violence than men, more likely to be harmed by their partner than men, more likely to be assaulted?
Absolutely. And I will say that, you know, I'm on my lunch break, so that technically wearing my work hat right now. But what I will say is that I am watching amazing work be done at the University of Wisconsin System to mitigate this, from even creating my position. My position was brand new. Right? And what does it mean to create a space to where mitigation and training can be done in this area specifically with youth? And I see that there are compliance offices and growing across system that are addressing just these things. Like every day it gets stronger and stronger. There's not the invisibility. You know, Me Too helped a lot of organizations to realize that these things were going on, and it kind of brought visibility to it. And so I think that, you know, all higher ed spaces are moving to a better space in this. And so I can say that for my position work-wise, I've definitely seen change. Now, where I'm seeing more change needs to be addressed is how we talk about it at an earlier age to mitigate it. So I think that's more of my kind of area of expertise. My expertise is youth, not necessarily the adult space. And so talking about, you know, abuse prevention, talking about, you know, people always talk about abuse prevention like it's adult to minor, but peer-to-peer is six times more likely to happen. So what does it mean when a child sexually molests or abuses or touches another child? And then it goes back to hurt people, hurt people. So if you have a child that's been being hurt at home, and then they in turn come to school and hurt a peer at school, the cycle continues on. And there's statistics out there that say 95% of abuse that happens to children is preventable through education. But yet you don't see abuse prevention as part of any curriculum.
Okay.
Any curriculum.
No, but we got to say that again, though, because I think you just said 95% of abuse experienced by children is preventable through education.
Yes, 95% is preventable. There's consumer education methods so you can talk to children so they can tell you when things feel icky before things get nasty, right? But we don't teach children how to communicate when things just get icky. We don't provide spaces, enough spaces for reporting, and then teaching children how to report. We don't tell children, you know, talk about their parts in a real way. Like we might call it, you know, their wee-wee, their pee-pee, and then when something happens, it's like a funny part of their body was touched, versus actually giving them the language to say, somebody touched my breast, somebody touched my penis, somebody touched my vagina. And, you know, I know with the younger kids that those words can be hard, and I've been working with my nieces and nephews, and one of the things that we talk about is the treasures of our no-no box. And we call it a no-no box because no one, nobody should be touching these treasures. And that when you're old enough one day to give them away, they're for you to give away. Even as an adult, nobody can take your treasures. And so it was really interesting. My niece was in line one day and a kid ran back past her really fast and ended up touching her on the bottom. And she screamed, she goes, he touched my no-no box. The teacher freaked out and was like, okay, what's a no-no box? What happened? And she said, he touched my behind. So she knew the names inside of her box. She knows the names of all of her treasures. But being able to empower her with the words allowed her to say something right away. So when we talk about 95% of abuse being preventable through education, it's educating the children. It's educating the community. It's educating the people that have access, privacy, and control to your children. This is how we keep them safe. But there's one more giant risk to our children, and that is specifically with young Black female children. They're not seen as children. They're seen as adults. Whenever anything happens with a teen or a middle school age girl, you see even in the press that they say a young woman was assaulted or a young woman was in an altercation today. No, a child, a teenager. But when the press and the way the community sees them is already as an adult, they are going to be treated as such. And I just think that that's one of the greatest risks that is posed to our young children today. So when we talk about, you know, how do we prevent Title IX violations? How do we prevent peer-to-peer sexual abuse? It starts with education. It starts with accountability. It starts with having the difficult conversations. And did you know that you're supposed to start talking to children about their private parts when they are 3 years old, as young as 3 years old? Now think about it. How many people started that conversation at 3 years old? Mm-hmm. And the way that people are successful with abuse, it goes back to the abuse equation, access, privacy, and control. All a predator needs to be successful, whether it's peer-to-peer or adult to minor, is access to your child. That can simply be the babysitter. That could simply be in the classroom as a teacher or as a classmate. Then they need privacy. Well, mommy and daddy had to go to work, so I'm alone with the babysitter. Oh, well, I went to the bathroom during school and somebody was alone with me in the bathroom or in the hallway. And last but not least is control. Fear is a total control factor with children. Also, when all those things were happening in church hurt, they were telling the children that their families could face eternal damnation. Could you think of a greater fear to a child than knowing that their whole family could go to hell if they didn't perform a sexual act? So people are successfully carrying out the abuse equation because there's not the education out in our community so that they understand why these things happen. So that's where I am. I am an advocate for the education. I am an advocate for being in spaces and helping people understand what's happening in our communities. So when you see me on my soapbox yelling at the top of my lungs, protect the children, I'm really screaming, educate yourselves, educate your community. Let's get ahead of this.
I think, you know, I'm so grateful for everything you just said, but I do want to hone in on Title IX, because Title IX underwent some pretty intense changes during Donald Trump's administration that really placed a lot of onus on a person who is accusing another person of doing something. Right. Really shifted who is prioritized in that dynamic within schools and among children. Right. So a 6-year-old says this person hurts me, and that 6-year-old becomes responsible for proving that versus a series of steps to protect that 6-year-old being taken. Biden has very swiftly, you know, really
removed a lot of those.
Removed a lot of those. But I can't help but think about the long lasting damage that that message sends, that a 6-year-old comes forward and says, somebody hurt me. And our job is not to protect them, is not to, you know, create spaces for them to talk about it. But our job becomes to investigate them, to see whether or not they're telling the truth, to presume that the person that they have accused is innocent until otherwise proven, no matter what the age of.
But you know how this happened, right? Conversations were had about victims versus with them. Mm. Because they would have explained that creating those types of barriers is one of the reasons why people don't report. And the more successful people are at getting away with harming others, the more they'll continue to hurt others. So by putting that parameter and onus and burden of proof on a child to prove it, they'd rather not say anything at all. At all. And I think about, you know, I was younger, I was 9 years old, and I had a minister put his hand on my lap and rub it and say, it is your fault if men look at you. He tried to say it in the nicest way. I wanted to let you know it was your fault if men looked at you. One, I didn't even know why we were having that conversation. And luckily, I felt empowered enough to tell my mother that something was off. But now that I have the words now, I understand that he was grooming me. And I couldn't imagine at 9 years old having to prove that this grown man who had control over me because he was the principal of the school, I would have to prove that he touched me at 9 years old. There's no way. I would have never told anyone because I would have assumed that I wouldn't be believed, right? Mm. Children's frontal lobes are underdeveloped. Children sometimes do lie. And my mind would say, well, why wouldn't they choose this opportunity to decide that I'm lying? Why wouldn't they? Mm. Right? So why am I going to tell? Because I don't know if they're going to believe me or not anyway. It was probably one of the most detrimental things that they put in that legislation. But once again, it was coming from people having conversations about it versus people who were in the midst and going through it.
Well, and it was also enacted by a president who had been accused of sexual assault, you know, dozens of times. And so to have the people who perpetrate a crime against a group of people also be the people who decide how that crime is looked at and perceived throughout our lives, throughout our childhoods, is an interesting factor to think about, right? I wonder if you look to, you know, what Biden has done in terms of revising Title IX, and think there are areas in which we need greater strength. We need a greater requirement. There are only 13 states in the United States, y'all, that require sexual education human growth and development to be medically accurate. Okay. Mm. 13 states in the United
States. Think on it.
Require us to be medically accurate when we talk about human growth and development. What should we be getting from Title IX that we're not getting from Title IX that you would like to see in your position, in your role at the UW system, that you think would strengthen this and that would allow for, you know, victims' rights advocates to be more effective?
Like I said, UW system, I do not do Title IX and I don't do adult type issues. But as far as the Title IX space for youth, middle school, high school students, my biggest recommendation is that so much of our policy is based in mandated reporting. Mandated reporting is what you do after the fact. I would advocate for proactive prevention methods in these spaces, proactive education in these spaces. That is what's missing from all of this legislation, is that all of it is based on what we do after something has happened to someone. And I'll go back to the abuse statistic. 95% is preventable through education. So why wouldn't you mandate the education part with all of these revisions?
Mm. Pernicia Clifton, having you with us today is such an incredible, it's just an incredible opportunity to not only think about what we are doing in the history of this reality in terms of violence against women, the intersectionality in terms of violence against women of color, but also to think about the possibility for doing things differently and what that looks like and what happens when young women have these tools, when young people have these tools to navigate consent, to navigate, rejection, to navigate peer pressure in a way.
To navigate mental health.
Right.
Let's not forget about that.
Right. In a way that allows for them to be safe. Right. And you would think, you know, we're living through a global pandemic right now. You would think this conversation about safety would just kind of rise to the surface, that we can keep each other safe. Right. We can be well informed and make sound decisions about the best practices we engage in. And that can not only protect us, but our communities, but each other, our kids, our loved ones, our families. And yet there's some real push and pull around that conversation. What is the resistance to your work that you've experienced as you have, you know, tried to prevent child abuse? You would think that everybody would be like, we're on board, we're invested, this is what we want to do. What, how do people get out of doing this work?
So in the 20 years that I've been doing this work, from private sector to universities, I think people aren't ill-intentioned about doing the work, but there's still that assumption that it won't happen here, so we don't need the work. Let me say that again. People are not ill-intentioned, they're ill-informed, and make assumptions that it won't happen here. And therefore, they prioritize money for training and time for training in other areas and say, well, we have mandated reporting in place, you know, and so we know what to do afterwards. But we're not prioritizing the education in the forefront. So that's the resistance that I get. And, you know, I understand people are reactionary. Very seldomly are we proactive. I mean, think about the number of people that don't go and get annual medical checkups. We go to the doctor when we need the doctor, right? So we do abuse prevention or prevention against harm of children after the child has already been harmed. And we need to change that culture of thought in order to get ahead of this. So that is the biggest challenge I face, is changing the culture of thought.
But, you know, we look at how children are treated differently. And I would say, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation around both gender and race is because the reaction to young white women pursuing help, the reaction to young white women, engaging in misconduct to whatever degree, seems so different than the reaction that women of color, that trans women experience. And I think it's hard for folks to see that or to flesh that out if you're not experiencing it. But, you know, when you talk about the adultification of Black girls and brown girls, you talk about the hypersexualization of Black girls and brown girls, you have to acknowledge that we are oriented to be more violent towards one group of girls than the other, right? You see images of a police officer with his knee on the back of a Black girl in a bikini. What threat could she possibly possess? She's got, like, you know, 18 inches of fabric on, you know, like what could she possibly be hiding or doing? But you don't see images like that with white women. You don't see images like, you know, police officers at schools throwing young white girls out of their desks. In fact, the last year that MMSD had police officers in schools, not a single white student was arrested. Every single child arrested at school was a person of color.
But think about who's going to be stopped. The communities that are going to be stopped are the ones that are policed the most. So if inherently we're perceived as more violent, we're perceived as more of a threat, we are going to be observed more and then arrested more. We are not equally seen as human beings. I don't even think we even got to the point of three-fifths of a human, honestly, when they said that that's equivalently what Black people were. We never, ever even got to be seen as three-fifths. And so when you talk about people like Micaiah Bryant, I wonder if anyone stopped right there and assessed the mental health state of the people involved in that interaction. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and we're having mental health crises. 1 in 10 youth are having a mental health crisis, and they're saying during the pandemic, it might be 1 in 7. So is the reaction for a person in a mental health crisis just to show up and shoot? And keep in mind, she's the one that called and asked for help. And so I also say we're not allowed to need help. We're not allowed to be in crises because the assumption is we caused the crises. We're to blame for the crises, right? And so my heart aches for Micaiah Bryant when we know that she called for help and said that she was being attacked. And I think about, you know, the amount of bullying that I experienced as a young person. It almost makes me extremely emotional, you know, because I went to a predominantly white school and I was bullied by, you know, the girls all the time. And when I would tell the teachers would tell me I was overreacting. But the minute one of the other white girls in the class said that, you know, I said something snarky back, they addressed me immediately. And it was a constant experience in school for me. And so when we're not allowed to have a voice, they're setting us up to be victims. They're setting us up to be over-policed and over-assumed a threat, because when we do respond back, it's after we've taken all we could. And so, yeah, it does look like a blow-up. And yeah, it does look scarier than when Becky just says, oh, stop it, right? So if we don't intercede early on and kind of take the little fuse and diffuse it and let a little bit of air out of the tank at a time, sometimes the response is an immediate explosion. At least I know from my experience growing up as a youth, that was it.
If you are just joining this conversation, you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow, and this is A Public Affair. And I want to go back to, Pernicia, what you were just saying, because I think, you know, in your role as the Director of Youth Protection and Compliance at the University of Wisconsin System, the conversation around self-defense, right? Self-defense, as part of, for me, in the 90s, growing up in the 90s, self-defense was a real part of the conversation. You know, in terms of women taking classes, in terms of women, you know, you're promoting this idea that you have the right to say no, you have the right to stand up for yourself if somebody doesn't listen to you. If somebody invades your space, hurts your body, you should know how to protect yourself. And yet, with Black and brown women, when Black and brown women, you know, defend themselves in terms of domestic violence, defend themselves in verbally, defend themselves in any way, the immediate reaction, the consequence is for them. It's never for the person who was hurting them. It's never seen as, oh, well, you were being attacked by this adult, and so you got something to defend yourself. It's seen as you are the aggressor, you are the violent one. And I think about how to survive in that reality, right? How do you survive in a world that won't protect you and also will punish you if you protect yourself? And I'm wondering, how do you have that conversation with folks? How do you have that conversation with young girls?
Well, it goes back to it takes a village, and that we have to build our villages up to protect our young women. And we have to hold accountability when our village doesn't protect them. So I think it was good when, you know, we came out for George Floyd, but we haven't seen the same reaction for Micaiah. We came out in drones and cried tears over DMX with his drug overdose. But yet Whitney Houston, during her drug overdose, became the blunt of most jokes. There wasn't the same outcry. There wasn't the same support or understanding that, you know, she was an addict. She was experiencing a disease. And so our own community doesn't protect us. And I think it sets precedent to why others don't have to protect us. And so I think that it's going to be double faceted. One, we have to show that we've already shown that we're worthy of protection, but we have to show that we're demanding it now. We have to raise our voices when we see things like Micaiah happen and say, this is why it's wrong. I used to be a behavior specialist in a classroom, and I had a kid beat me up to the point that it put me in the hospital. He had messed up my C-spine and had a couple of herniated discs. He had also done the same thing to the principal. It took three police officers to restrain him. He had had a growth on a pituitary gland that it made him violent, and he was reenacting wrestling moves. But in the time of them restraining the young boy, who was over 6 foot and white, I never once saw a taser pulled out. I never once saw a gun pulled out. I never once saw any kind of harm. But yet, when we see Black girls arrested for getting in fights with their peers or whatever in the classroom, it's a drag out fight, hair being pulled. You know, there's no humanity in the restraints. We're not given that. And I think that it goes back to holding those people that are charged with that work accountable for how they do the work. And what does equity, not equality, what does equity in the work look like? Meaning the oversight, meaning the remediation, and meaning the actual attention given to incidences. The other thing is that when stuff happens to Black girls and Black women, seldomly do you see action. I can't tell you the number of Amber Alerts that I see for white children when we know that Black children are disappearing at an exponential rate to that. But there's not an inherent value. And so how do we fix that? We call out accountability. We say, okay, hey, this young Black girl is missing. Where is her Amber Alert? And we have to say it every single time, because if we don't bring it up as a community that someone is missing, no one else is, unfortunately.
And I think, you know, what we do as a society, for me, is different than what we do as individuals navigating this reality. It's different than what we tell our children, right? And if you want to participate in this conversation, you want to join us on WORT 89.9, the number is 608-256-2001. Press 9, and our brilliant producer, Rochelle, will patch you through to the show. You can join us for this conversation. But I think, you know, what do you tell a little girl? What do you say? You say, if you call the police, they're going to arrest you. They're going to shoot you. If you try to protect yourself, you're going to get in trouble. Is the message, take it and hope somebody notices? Is the message, play dead until it's over? What are you supposed to tell a little girl to do when she needs help in a society that can respond to a child's call for help by shooting her over and over again in the chest?
Hmm. I mean, how is that even the protocol? And was there even enough time to realize, was she defending herself or was she the perpetrator? There was no time in that reaction. And, you know, I get it. They're like, well, she had a knife and blah, blah, blah. But I still don't think that a fatal response was necessary. There's been plenty of instances where people have been in mental health crises with knives and even guns, where police have used de-escalation tactics.
Right.
People and I just have to say, where are those tactics when it comes to Black people in crises?
Right. People have compared her to, you know, mass murderers or mass shooters who are heavily armed and walk out of the shopping center with the police, right? Not a scratch on them. You know, you think about somebody like Breonna Taylor, who, again, pose no threat. She's asleep in her own bed. And it's interesting, you know, when you talk about how we as a community, how we as a globe responded to George Floyd. And I think that there are a lot of reasons why we responded to George Floyd differently than we have a lot of other people who have been brutalized or killed by the police, in part because he was not shot, right? And I think we are desensitized to seeing Black people shot by police, but George Floyd wasn't. But you think of him and you think of Breonna Taylor, and there is a parallel in terms of timeline, right? These are two people who are murdered by the police at the same time. And there has been a tremendous outcry around Breonna Taylor, but nobody was sentenced to go to prison for murdering her, right?
Right.
And that was not seen as the same kind of, you know, that wasn't seen the...
But we're seen as disposable. We're seen as disposable. Oh, well, it happened during an accident. Oh, well. But when that officer in Minnesota had killed the white Australian woman, he got 12 years. No question asked. Even though there was documentation, it was an accident, it wasn't intentional, he still got 12 years for shooting that white woman. Why? Because there was value seen in her life. Mm-hmm. Even though Breonna was a first responder and everything else, the value seen in her life was not equitable.
But was the value seen in George Floyd's life equitable to the value of Breonna Taylor's? Like, is there a reason why, you know? And I think George Floyd is kind of this, you know, global moment in which the whole world is watching this trial, in which people have protested not only domestically but internationally, and so I think we got a result that isn't particularly common when police kill Black people, whether they're men or women, you know.
Well, and it comes down to the people controlled the video. The people filmed it in real time without edits. And George Floyd, we saw in real time this happening. The difference between Breonna Taylor and George Floyd is that we didn't see the real video. Mm. To this day, we'll never know. And so some people, because they don't see equity in our value, are going to assume we must have had done something wrong because we don't have a video that proves otherwise. We're not presumed innocent until proven guilty. We're presumed guilty until you provide a video that shows you're innocent, specifically with Black women. If there would have been a video that the police officer could have seen ahead of time with Micaiah Bryant defending herself, then maybe he would have seen equity in her value and not shot her, de-escalated the situation, and actually helped her. But because we are presumed guilty upon arrival without video documentation, we will not get those same interventions and those same protections. It is a culture change that has to happen.
And so do we tell young women of color, young Black women, young trans women, not to call for help? Do we say calling for help is dangerous? Don't do it.
I mean, if I'm having this conversation with my niece, I'm still going to have her call for help. Because the alternative is that you may lose. And I've lost enough bullying situations to know that that help probably would have helped me. And I think that, you know, not that I was in fights, but that I was bullied, you know, and that nobody intervened. I didn't have any help. And so I'm not going to tell young Black women to not ask for help if harm is happening, especially... I'm thinking about a 5'3" young girl being attacked by in a domestic abuse situation, and she's, you know, having to protect herself against her spouse or her partner. I'm always going to tell them to call for help because there's no sensible way that they're going to just survive that.
But are you going to warn them, hey, when you call for help, when you call for help, you might get hurt. You might be the one who gets arrested. In fact, statistically speaking, when you call for help and you report domestic violence of all women, you're the most likely woman to get arrested and blamed for your assault.
I think it's going to be the same way that we have to talk up to Black people about being pulled over with a traffic stop. Mm. We have to be told how to manage a traffic stop because this society, unfortunately, has a history of treating our traffic stops differently. So, you know, both hands on the wheel, make sure that everything is visible, make sure your license and registration is out, make sure you tell them every step you're taking so they know. What does that mean in a phone call for a Black woman calling to get assistance from a police? Hi, I am a Black woman. I have blonde hair. I'm wearing a blue shirt. I am the one being attacked. Please let the officer know I'm the one being attacked so that they know that I am not the perpetrator upon arrival. Yes, it sounds disgusting and it sounds horrible. But at the same time, we've already put a temporary intervention in place to protect us when being pulled over by police. And Lord knows that that's not always effective, but it's been somewhat effective, right? And I'm afraid that as a Black woman, that's how I'll have to explain it to my niece. That if you're ever in a domestic situation and you're having to defend yourself, or if you're ever in a fight and somebody is harming you and you call the police, make sure they know who the person is that's calling and asking for help. And it breaks my heart just saying it out loud. But that is the environment that we're in.
Yeah, I feel like it's a little bit of a place. Yeah, there's a little bit of painfulness to that reality in terms of if you need help, there's a series of steps that you have to take to get it that are different from what other people would be expected to have to do in a situation like that because of what you look like, because of the color of your skin. And I think, you know, trying to explain something like that to my 11-year-old or to my 7-year-old, you know, is complex. I think that's part of the reason why you have the resistance to education in the community is I'm like, oh man, do I just kind of shatter the fantasy my child has that the world can be fair? You know, when Donald Trump was elected, my oldest daughter was 7 years old at the time, and she said, Mommy can't be president. He's a bad person. And one of my friends said, did you tell her that, you know, a lot of politicians are bad people? And I said, no, because I don't want her to be jaded in that way. I don't want her to look at the world as this place that she can't trust or believe in or ask for help. I don't want that to be how she sees the world because she doesn't see it that way. And who am I to rush her into seeing how harsh a reality it really is? If I can, you know, if I can mitigate that and cultivate within her a sense of childish wonder, isn't that part of the aim? And I guess I'm listening to you and you're like, no, be honest and tell kids this is the reality. But do you ever feel like, man, we're cheating these kids out of being kids, right?
No, honestly, I think honesty is part of being a child. I still remember my mom telling me at 6 years old, I was really frustrated when I saw one of my classmates just running around and doing all sorts of bad stuff. But when I would do the same thing, just being a little girl running around, I got in trouble constantly by the teacher. And my mom pulled me aside and she said, Pernicia, you're not white. That was the first time that I understood what unfair was. And she said, I didn't make the rules. All I can do is try to change them. But at this time, in this current environment, you cannot do the same thing as your white friends do. Mm. And I mean, to be that young and to hear that was devastating. I still remember how I felt. But at the same time, I was glad that I knew that. Mm. I was glad that I was able to put protective factors in my life and to be mindful that people looked at me differently so I could look at them differently. Mm. Right? Mm. So I think that it's okay to be honest with children so that they're not surprised when bad things happen and they know how to mitigate it as it's approaching versus responding to it after it happens. So I think you're giving them protective factors by being honest.
Oh, I completely agree with you. It breaks my heart in a really serious way. I'm like, I don't know why I find it to be such a harsh thing. You know, it's kind of the idea of when you introduce your children to racism, to hatred, to rape culture, right? We have a caller on the line who doesn't want to come on the air but wants to ask, police killing people, killing Black people, is modern day lynching. But would it help with the Defund the Police movement to also highlight the violence they commit against all communities, including white communities? I think that's actually an excellent question. I'm like, that, you know, do we need to have this conversation as a racialized conversation? Do we need to say this is a unifying dialogue, that these sorts of things can happen to all people? Yes. Why do we highlight the violence the police commit against the Black community?
Well, I think that it's a whole complicated structure. And I think that defunding the police / restructuring the police is really misunderstood. And it should be about reallocating resources for prevention measures versus reaction measures. And once again, I'll go back, you know, when I talk about abuse and 95% is preventable through education, I wonder how much research is out there about how much violence and harm to the communities is preventable through education and resources. And what would it be to reallocate resources to focus on the prevention side of things versus the reactionary side of things? Because I definitely see policing as a reactionary result. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I stand on defunding the police. I mean, restructuring the police. There are definitely things that we're going to need support in that we need police for. There's violence happening to women at an alarming rate that we need support in. There is, you know, different things happening in our community. But I also say that I heard a person once say that what if we reacted to police the way we reacted to firemen? And basically, if there's a fire, we call the firemen. And if we need the police, we call the police when we need them, versus the policing structure, which is currently they're looking for you to commit a crime. Firefighters aren't out there looking and waiting for fires to happen. They're called when the fires happen. So what does that mean in a police setting when they're called when they're needed versus just overly policing one population over the other? Statistically, if you're watched 24/7, somebody's going to catch you doing something wrong because we're human. We're not perfect. But yet Black folks aren't given the opportunity to be human because we're watched 24/7 and not allowed to do anything wrong and to make mistakes. And more specifically, Black youth, which is crazy to me because the frontal lobes aren't even developed. So they're going to make even more mistakes. But if you have someone watching you 24/7 and you're the only community being police, then of course you're going to be caught. Of course the statistics are going to paint you out as the violent one. Of course statistics are going to paint you out to be the criminal because you are the only folks being policed and observed 24/7.
One of the things I love about having this conversation with you is that you make this a very personal conversation and you talk about what it was like for you growing up. You talk about your own experiences with assault. You talk about your own experiences with bullying. But I have to say, you often talk about your mom's response and trusting your mom to be able to talk to her and trusting your mom to warn you, to help you navigate these situations from the body that you occupy. And I think, do you ever think like, man, that lady was a little ahead of her time? My mom was
absolutely.
She was really playing no games, and she was very aware. And I think about how many, you know, I think about how many moms want to be that support person for their kids, but mess up, like fumble in that moment, right? A friend of mine told me about an experience where a boy would lift up her skirt when she would walk past him on the bus. And her mom told her to wear shorts under her skirt. Didn't say anything to the boy, but her mom thought that was just like the solution. Like, well, outsmart him, wear an extra layer of clothes or wear some pants. You know, how did your mom know to support you the way that she did, to prepare you the way that she did?
Well, my mother didn't hide from a fight. You know, she was one that wasn't afraid to have the hard conversations. And I believe that if somebody would have done that to me as a child, one, she would have told me to tell him directly to stop it, tell the teacher, and then two, she would have went and talked to the teacher, the school, and everybody that would have listened. Because my mom was a woman that fought for her children, but not only fought for her children, all children. And I think she passed that legacy on to me, that you're not just a mom to one, you're a mom to all. And now I don't have any children as an adult, but I do see myself as a mother to all. And so if I'm walking down the street and I see a child by themselves, I'm going to ask where their parent is. If I see a child playing by a lake and I don't see an adult near them, I'm going to say, where's your adult? Right? Because it's going to take a village, because not every single child is going to have a mother like mine. And I see it as my duty to be able to be that support to mothers that can't be in that fight, to be that support to mothers who, you know, have maybe been through trauma themselves and can't advocate for themselves because they lost their voice in the trauma. So it goes back to being a village and making sure that you can be that support in your village.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I wanted to wrap this up. I had to bring in the fact that you are a renowned opera singer. And in part, I think I wanted to bring that in and tie that to this conversation, because I wondered if your art, your space to be loud, your space to be seen, if that is part of how you resolved the way the world positioned you. If art gave you some of the tools you needed to withstand a world that tells Black women they're not important.
I would have to say that opera definitely taught me that my voice mattered.
Yes.
Right? And it also taught me that the room is going to listen to the loudest voice in the room. And God
me with the loudest voice in the room.
Oh, you went out there for a second. You said, opera has also told me that folks are going to listen to the loudest voice in the room. And then you cut out when you said something gorgeous. Say what you said.
And then God endowed me with the loudest voice in the room as an opera singer.
I cannot thank you enough for joining us. I cannot thank you enough for what you brought to this conversation, and what it means to get to learn from you and hear your story, but also to know that you are in our community working to prevent violence against our children. I don't think I could be any more grateful than I am for you right now, my friend. This is, you know, our last minute. If there's one thing you want to make sure the folks who are listening know about you and the work that you're doing, what is that one thing before we exit the show?
It goes back to the old quote, to whom much is given, much is expected. I know that I am not the only person in this community that has been given these gifts and talents, and I would charge you all today to use your gifts and talents to support our youth.
So well said. Thank you so much for joining us on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. And thank you so much, Pernisha Clifton, for joining us today, for everything that you had to say. I will be back with y'all next week. Thank you.